Digging Deeper Without the Cold Face, the podcast that shares the incredible stories of the talented and passionate people in our industry. This episode of Digging Deeper Without the Cold Face brought to you by Easy Group, your trusted partner in vehicle rentals, mechanical services and sign solutions. Servicing Mackay, Moranbah and Emerald with dedication and excellence. Everything is easy with Easy Group. And your host, Jessica Rouse.
Now, Danny McCarthy grew up in the bush in Blackwater with no intention of following his father's footsteps and going into mining. But fast forward to today, and he is currently the managing director of Terracom. Now, Terracom acquired Blair Athol mine?
It is the Blair Athol mine.
Yeah, in Claremont in 2017. It's 100% owner-operated, which is awesome. And it's so great to see Queensland mines going from strength to strength, including Blair Athol, which has a great prosperous future ahead of it. Danny has had a really interesting career. He's worked in every part of mining, travelled overseas, spent some of his working life alongside his father, a man who taught him to always do what's right. Danny landed himself on the front cover of the May edition of the magazine. If you haven't seen it yet, it is a ripper. Danny, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Jess. Great to be here and talk about what's a great journey so far.
Yeah, it's such an interesting story. And as I said, it's an industry that you didn't intend on going into when you were at school and growing up in those mining communities.
Yeah, well, I mean, going back to, growing up as a kid in Blackwater and then in Glendon, I just always had a view that there was something else. There was something else out there. And I knew that once I'd gone into mining, I was pretty much going to stay there. And so I thought, well, I'll do it at the start rather than try and get out of mining, because I'd, been around mining all my life and love and value what mining has done for our family. So I sort of flipped it and went against the grain and got myself out into big old Sydney as a young 16-year-old at the time. And I guess the rest is current and future history.
And what was it like growing up in those mining towns? You mentioned towns like Glendon, obviously mining being the big employer in those areas. What was it like growing up in that?
Yeah, well, let me start at Blackwater. So Blackwater in the early 70s, which is when I came into being, was a town that had 12,000 people. So it was a town where it just thrived on its local community. There were so many mining companies. Back then, the Utah mines, which are now BMA mines, were in Blackwater. The South Blackwater mine, the Yarrabee mine, and other mines around the place. And there was a real sense of being and belonging. I mean, Blackwater was so big at the time; it had three A-grade football teams, rugby league teams. The Blackwater Devils, who I played for, had every grade from A grade down to under nines, and so it was a real sense of community, and everyone lived and worked in and around there, and it was just a great place to grow up. And then moving into Glendon was just another level. A one employer town back then, MIM were the owners of the mine, and since changed a number of times through to Xstrata and now Glencore. And I recall in 1983, when we first moved to Glendon, what is now a sealed road from the Peak Downs Highway at the Nebo Junction to the Glendon Township was a dirt road. And, that was 1983. And so that road didn't get fully sealed for probably the first year. And it was fun when it rained. There was black soil country around there, and you'd often see a half a dozen or a dozen cars off to the side waiting to get recovered. So it was a fun place. We used to go to school on a bus. The school was out by the mine site. So it was actually a travelling school. It was a construction school for the construction workers of the town and the mine. And every morning we'd assemble and get on the buses and go out to the school at the mine. And the biggest challenge for us kids was to get on the bus, which was the most unreliable, and break down. So we didn't have to go to school as much. So we were a bit mischievous, but it was a lot of fun, and it was very safe, and you could sort of go anywhere you wanted, and you know your friends or your parents knew you and who you were, and yeah, it was a very safe and you know very good environment to grow up.
Yeah, even from like talking, like the school environment would have been, sounds like it would have been so much more, had that community feel than what school does today, perhaps, in a sense.
Yeah, and you know, we did that, I think, for the first year, and then the Glendon State School and High School, which was one school combined, opened up, and then all of the sort of bus travel was done, and you know, we'd ride our BMX bikes or whatever to school and rack them up. And back in the day, you didn't have to lock your bike up. You'd come back in the afternoon and your bike's still there. And, yeah, it was just a really good place and, you know, a very, very tight community that shared all the values of what, you know, mining brought to them and has brought to many of their generations to follow.
Yeah. And despite seeing all of that growing up, it's not what you wanted to do when you left school. Tell me what your first job was.
Well, I mean, first job, apart from baking bread at the Glendon Bakery when I was a young fella, was straight into the military. So I recall it was mid-year in 1988 and I had left Glendon and got myself down to Sydney. Well, not myself, got to Sydney with, at the time, another 100 recruits like me that were young, probably a bit scared, probably a bit excited. And that's when we started our journey in the military. And for 2 years we studied, worked, gained knowledge and learned and did that out in Western Sydney, which is where the Naval Training College was. And, you know, it was quite great. And then I was fortunate enough to get a posting to what was my home port of Cairns. So in 1990, we headed north up to Cairns and spent 4 or 5 years up there before returning to Sydney and then eventually leaving the Navy to come back and forge the career that, you know, has been so great for myself and my family.
Yeah, and tell me about your family. So you met your wife while you were in the military?
I did. I met Lara in 1989. In Sydney, and you know, she is a Queensland girl and was living down there with her family.
Queenslanders always find each other, don't they?
They do. And so we started off not unlike any other young aspiring couples, and got together. And then in 1990, I convinced her to and her mother to let her come north. And we packed up all of our belongings, which fit snugly in a 6x4 box trailer, and we drove to Cairns. And I remember that was back in the day where you could literally drive into a town or a city, go to the local real estate, pick one or two things that were available, and by the end of the day we were moving our box trailer full of boxes into a one-bedroom flat where we stayed for a couple of years.
There you go.
So, yeah, it was quite the journey. And, you know, we were young and we were sort of starting off our own sort of journey together up in Cairns, and, yeah, it was great.
Yeah, what an adventure.
An adventure. And then in 1993, along came daughter number one, Taylor. She was born in Cairns, so she's a Queenslander by birth, and she currently works in the mining. She works for BMA as a supervisor. So she followed, left school, had a famous gap year from school, and never went on to uni. So her gap year continued to this day. So she had a great career with Tease, and then it's got herself into BMA, and she's going great. So that's a credit to her, and she's forged her own way, and she's become her own woman in her own right. So you know, the industry's been very good to her and her partner. And then we moved to back to Sydney in 1995, and then along came daughter number two, Brittany. So she was born in New South Wales, so she's the only New South Welsh person in the family, but she's certainly a Queenslander. So the irony there is that she shares the same birthday as Dad.
Oh, there you go.
And Dad was himself born in New South Wales and left there as a very young man and met my mother in Rockhampton, and so never returned to New South Wales to live, and forever declared himself a die-in-the-wool Queenslander, state of origin, Wally Lewis, the Broncos, all those things. So,
traitor. Yeah,
you wouldn't know him to be a New South Wales person, that's for sure.
I tell you what, the best people are born in 1995. I think I'd like your daughter very much.
Yes. Well, I'm sure she'll be happy to hear that. And the next addition to our little family is that Brittany, the 1995 model, is pregnant, and she's due to have our first grandchild in the coming weeks. So
how exciting. Yeah, and she's living up in Queensland as well?
Yeah, so Britt's a school teacher. She lives up in Mackay. So,
oh, nice.
Brittany decided that mining wasn't for her, and she went on and did musical theatre and all those things, and then really enjoyed early childhood care, and then went back to university again for a second time and got herself a master's in education. And she loves teaching, you know, year six, year sevens that she can relate to. She's a big kid herself. So.
That's awesome. Yeah. So when did you decide that mining may perhaps actually be for you?
Yeah, I mean, the military's a great career. It takes you away from your family a lot.
Mm.
And I had spent a lot of my time at sea, and so I didn't get to see the early years, certainly of Taylor growing up. I was away a lot, and you know, I always wanted to come home, and home to me was, you know, being in and around Mackay and the region, primarily for Mum and Dad, and to do that, I needed to, you know, get into mining. And I guess for me it wasn't unnatural choice. It was just something that I decided that military time was enough, and it was great. Yep. It was rewarding, and I had a lot of fun and a lot of experiences and travelled a lot and learnt a lot. And, I guess for me it was just time to come home and see what this mining stuff's all about.
Yeah. So what was your first job in the industry?
Yeah, well, first job, irony, was I did a I didn't have anything on the cards, and so, you know, and that's unlike me. I'm not a risk taker.
You're a planner.
At all. I like to plan things. And anyway, I said to my I said to Lara, I said, look, I'm just going to head up there and take it as it comes, and then when I get a job, I'll call for you and get you and the girls up. And so a friend of my sister's ran an electrical business, so I started off-siting for him in and around Mackay. That was quite fun, you know, doing odd jobs here and there, and
yeah.
I guess putting my trade to work. And that was interesting, but not rewarding or fulfilling nor challenging. And so I thanked Rick, I just recalled his name, for his time and his effort that he spent with me. And he always knew it was going to be a temporary thing.
Yep.
And my father at the time, it's funny how the world works, he did a bunch of favours for a bunch of people in his career, and one guy in particular was pretty senior in a mine at the time, and all the planets aligned, and I was able to get onto a shutdown. And for the next 8 weeks, I was working on a dragline shutdown, and that was quite interesting for me. I made a lot of friends, a lot of mates. So, first real job in mining was a dragline shutdown at Newlands, actually.
There you go.
Newlands Coal, where Dad was working. So
yeah,
there you go. And the other part of that is, it seems to me everyone I talk to has a story about Blair Athol. Before I got the job with Tease to build South Walker Creek as part of that team, I did a small job at the Blair Athol mine when it was one complex, upgrading the PLC and the stacker reclaimer.
There you go. So,
back then in 1996, I had some involvement in what is now an asset that's managed by Glencore, but certainly still on the Blair Athol mining list. So there you go.
Yeah, full circle.
It does, yeah.
I love it. And you mentioned your dad. You had the opportunity to work alongside him for a while in mining early on.
Yes, that was pretty special. Dad had been at Newlands Coal since 1983. He was one of the first six employees at Newlands Coal, and I think from memory they drew six numbers out of a hat, and I think he got number one. So officially he was the first employee at Newlands.
Yeah.
There was a time where there was some changes happening at Newlands. South Walker Creek offered an opportunity for Dad to enjoy a even time roster, getting on in the back end of his career, and that meant he got to spend a lot more time fishing and so on his days off. And so, as fate would have it, the same person that helped me, that Dad helped 30 years ago, helped him. And Dad came to South Walker Creek as OCE, and we got to spend a couple of years working together, not in the same department. I was in the processing department, but on the mine, and there were certainly occasions where Dad would have to come and interact with myself and others. And it was just really, really good because he held court a lot in a lot of conversations, and, you know, a lot of people listened to him, and,
yeah,
you know, they forged very, very fond memories and bonds with him, you know, at South Walker Creek, particularly a lot of young people that were there. So, yeah, that was quite special.
I was going to say, what was the relationship like working with your dad? Was it quite like he wasn't dad, he was the OCE, if that makes sense?
There was probably a combination, but deep down he was known at the time. He used to, for all of his sins, he used to smoke a pipe. And he was called, his nickname in the industry is the Pipe. And people will still refer to him, even he stopped smoking altogether, you know, long before he passed on. But
yeah,
he was always referred to as the Pipe. And so, you know, he was everyone's mate. And I guess for me it was never really about, you know, whether it was dad or not. It was just a good bloke to have as part of your team.
Yeah.
That was probably the kind of relationship that he liked as well.
Would you say you learnt a bit off your dad while you were working with him and seeing him interact with employees, how he did?
Yeah, for sure. And I guess it cemented all of the sort of life lessons that he'd given me from, you know, a kid and growing up and getting into trouble and, you know, only things that dads can help with. And,
yeah,
you know, he just had a way about him where you could go to him with anything, and, you know, that teaches you to be able to be that person. Don't always get it right. Haven't always got it right. In fact, I've had some clangers in my career where I, you know, if I had my time again, I'd, you know, sort of rewind the tape and go, wow, that's a massive learning opportunity.
Yeah.
And it still is. But if you had your time again, you'd probably redo it. So I think as a young bloke, the values, the teachings, the learnings, and then to see that play out in a workplace per se about how he carried himself, and it was as much about what he didn't say as what he did say. And he was a very, very powerful thinker and a very influential person to have. And he would always advocate, and I know this is the title of it, but he would always advocate for what was right. And, you know, that that endeared him to mine managers, rank and file, executives. I don't know how many times growing up as a kid where there would be senior mine executives at our house getting advice from Dad on what would he do? How would you attack this? So, you know, I guess we took all that for granted. We didn't know who these people were, but, you know, looking back, you know, some of them were mine managers, general managers, company executives, and, you know, I think, you know, equally listening to what his counsel was, whether they always took it or not, but he seemed to be able to relate to anyone.
Yeah. What a wonderful person to have in your life to look up to and learn from.
Yeah, 100%.
That's beautiful. Was that particular job for your dad the last job of his mining career?
Yeah. So when he put the queue in the rack to really go and pursue, you know, his sort of fishing, love of fishing, and, you know, him and Mum did a couple of trips around Australia, you know, first in a towing a camper van and then vowing to never do that, then buying a caravan and towing that around and then vowing to never do that, you know, to fishing trips and those things. And probably one of the biggest regrets for me is I never got to do a trip up the Cape with him. And part of that was I blame him for this, my loyalty to the person that I was working for. The shutdown I talked about at Newlands back in 96, there was a massive trip to the Gulf organised, and I was to go with Dad. And then the shutdown ran over by 3 weeks and they were calling for people, and I said, well, okay, I've got to make a decision here. Am I going to go to the Gulf with Dad, or am I going to stay here and do what's right? Right?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'm going to get that chance to go to the Gulf. I'm not necessarily going to get a chance to be the person that puts a hand up to stay here, da-da-da-da. And so, but I never got to go to the Gulf with that. So that was probably one of the biggest regrets of doing what was right by the employer. Yeah.
That shows an awful lot of loyalty and commitment, you know, two of the values that I'm sure employees want in their workers, and something that you should value in yourself too.
Yeah, I think they're two great ones. You know, there's a whole heap of pressure on everyone, and I think you know, we're our own business. We're not immune to pressures of internal and external things. And, you know, I think if you share a common value of you know, putting the shoulder to the wheel and showing up and keep grinding it out, then that's what makes a company and what makes a culture. And, you know, that's what we're endeavouring to do at Terracom, is, you know, assemble as many like-minded people that want to have an opportunity to work in a pretty hard and fast environment, but also have a bit of fun at the end of the day. And, you know, that formula is very difficult to get right all the time.
Yeah. So how did Terracom come about?
Yeah, well, I was over in Western Australia at the time with Lara, and, you know, one of the big – and I had a great job over there in WA, and learned a lot and expanded a lot of my knowledge and sort of commodity base. And, you know, coming back was centred around Dad's health. I remember in April 2018, he and Mum came over to Perth. It was the first time since we'd been there. We'd been there about 2.5 years at that point. And I decided to turn it on for Dad, because Dad had a few sicknesses when he retired, you know, one of which was sort of annoying for him to do sort of long travel. So we'd just done a decent deal with a big airline at the time for our FIFO workforce, and I asked them to sort of lay it on pretty thick from sort of point of boarding in Mackay right through to Perth, you know, picking this guy up at the gate and chaperoning him to the VIP lounge and, you know, all this stuff. And he hated every minute. And so I got a gob for when he got to Perth.
I can imagine.
After the first couple of beers, he said, "You know what? That was really good. I really appreciate it." I said, "Yeah, no worries." But he wasn't well. He wasn't well at the time. I remember saying, "Lara," I said, "Dad doesn't look well." And so, you know, we made some decisions to start to plot our course back to the East Coast. And we did that. Wal King was the chairman of Terracom at the time, and I'd worked for Wal indirectly, but yep, directly as part of the Leighton Group, Tease, and used to get exposure to Wal at the famous quarterly reviews where you're either making money or you're losing money, and that depended on which way the conversation went. And, you know, and so gravitating through that to Wal, and then obviously having an opportunity to be based very close to Mum and Dad up in Central Queensland, tick boxes and you know, being home in and around our girls, it all sort of fell into place. So yeah, that's when the career started on the 1st of December 18.
Yeah. And it sounds like you've had quite the career with them. You travelled overseas with Terracom?
Yeah, I joined Terracom on the 1st of December 2018. I was on a plane to Mongolia on the 2nd of December.
There you go.
I tell you, and I remember it was December, so it was hot and humid in Queensland, 36 degrees when I boarded the plane in Mackay. And some, I don't know, 30 hours later, I've landed in a country that I'd never been to, Mongolia, in the capital city, Ulaanbaatar, and it was minus 36.
Oh, my God.
In the space of, I don't know, 30 hours, it was a 72-degree turnaround. And I remember thinking, wow, this is quite the adventure. And luckily, Lara and I had gone and stocked up in Kathmandu on, you know, all the – I had more warm weather equipment than I think, you know, some of the North Pole expedition people. And so I've gone there, and that was quite interesting. And it then got even colder down in the South Gobi Desert where the mine was. I remember being out in the pit, and I was, of course, fascinated by everything. And I remember taking my gloves off to start taking photos, and then within 3 seconds, I think my hands were going to just break off from being frozen. It was minus 50 wind chill factor out in the mine.
Oh, my God.
So here's this boy from Central Queensland, you know, sleeping in the traditional Mongolian gur tent. So our camp in the South Gobi Desert were these traditional Mongolian gur tents. They're called gurs.
Oh, my goodness.
They're amazing. And so they're all sort of, rather than the dongas that you see at our camps here, there's these tents, and there was coal-fired heaters. And so all through the night, there's people going around to everyone's tent and restocking the coal.
Oh,
to
wow.
Keep them warm. And these things are like an oven. And so if you don't regulate the temperature correctly, which after the first few visits I worked out how to do it, you're literally in there sweating. So, you know, it's minus 40 degrees outside and it's like a sauna. So,
oh, my God.
It was interesting and intriguing. And I ended up travelling there. I think I checked my passport in 18 months. I did about 10 in-and-out visits. So I was there quite a lot. So that was interesting.
Quite an adventure.
Up to Asia and then, of course, when we bought South Africa and, you know, business dealings in Singapore, Hong Kong and, you know, China and Japan and all those things. So I've been fortunate to travel, you know, with work. It's not all glamorous, but, you know, it's an amazing experience. For sure.
Yeah. You'd see, like, was there much, obviously it sounds like there was a big difference between, like, culture and how they mine between, like, here, for instance, and Mongolia and then South Africa?
Yeah, it's all smaller scale, similar method, but yeah, smaller scale. And and different challenges. So, you know, in Mongolia, one of the biggest challenges was pumping water away from mining areas because by the time you pump it, it's frozen. And so, you know, the challenges that we take for granted over here, moving water around the pit, are, you know, it's a big challenge. And then you've got all these geologists that are out on pit floor guiding the excavators to where the proper coal is. And, you know, they're out there all day. They don't get to go and have a break. So same principles, different scale.
Yeah.
And, you know, a different knowledge base and experience base for employees. And a lot of that comes from education and, you know, the sort of ethos around communities and opportunities that people have. And one of the common threads, though, for me, which I really enjoyed, and I got to spend time with some of our workforce out in the country, in Mongolia and certainly in South Africa, was they're all beautiful people. They exist in a different world. They have different things that they do, and they all have a common. They're very deeply rooted in family values.
Yeah,
particularly, you know, in Mongolia and, you know, the South African people that we have. So, yeah, it really gives a different light, and it shows how lucky we are in our country to enjoy not only the freedoms but the things that we take for granted, flicking on a light switch, you know, and so that gives you a real good perspective as well.
Yeah, definitely. So your role now with Terracom, less travel, more just staying in the one spot?
Yeah, less travel. I'm not going to South Africa as much as I did, although we still have business interests there. Yeah, and so, you know, still out and about, when required, but not as much.
Yeah. So tell me about the asset. Tell me about Blair Athol for anyone who may not know very much.
Yeah. So Blair Athol first started extracting coal back in 1864. It was discovered drilling a couple of water wells and this black stuff was there. So, you know, it's got a long history. You know, the Blair Athol Township had to be relocated to facilitate the mine. And so Blair Athol, before we got hold of it in 2017, was an amazing Rio Tinto asset who really leveraged the large seam. You know, the famous thing, you Google burning coal, Blair Athol, and you'll see Rio Tinto's shovels picking up coal that's on fire and putting into the back of trucks.
Oh, wow.
You know, such was the volatility in SpondCom susceptibility. So very, very interesting history. Mm. And when Rio decided to put it into care and maintenance in 2012 due to their own reasons, for all intents and purposes, Blair Athol, you know, was done. And so Seam 4 exists at Blair Athol, which is a seam that we're exploiting. And we've been extracting that since we got hold of it and restarted in 2017.
Yeah.
Got about 7 years or thereabouts remaining at our current production rate. And, you know, Blair Athol's asset, God love the previous owners who built it. They built it as a bulletproof asset, you know, big brick buildings, big workshops, overhead cranes, you know, everything was done largesse, and you don't see that sort of thing these days. So they've given us a great head start, and, you know, part of Blair Athol's future is the Moorlands project, which is within 15 k's where we're currently in very, very advanced negotiations and discussions with the owners of that deposit to ultimately develop Moorlands as a satellite pit to Blair Athol, using all of the infrastructure, the processing and the rail loading facilities, which really gives a head start to that mine and gives a nice future for our people and the community and the region, because it's, you know, apart from BA, there's the Glencore mine, which, you know, has its own life of mine, which will end in the next few years. So this really gives a good certainty for the community for 25, 30 years to come beyond Marathol's coal resource.
Yeah. It's so nice to see. It always feels like a different vibe in Queensland compared to New South Wales when it comes to new mines opening up and extensions and all that sort of thing. It seems to happen a lot in Queensland, which is great. Do you think the future for the coal industry in Queensland is quite strong?
Well, yes, I do. The Queensland government are well dialed in, absolutely. Every time I see, the relevant ministers speak, the resounding comments are Queensland's open for business. Mm. And that's great and it's refreshing. And there's a number of projects that have probably got stuck in the green machine for way too long. And that doesn't mean be irresponsible. That doesn't mean don't do the right thing. You know, of course, all of those things are important and they must be part of the fabric, the governance and the deliverables for ultimately projects to get approval. Otherwise, we're going to have chaos and no one wants that. So I do believe that Queensland's ahead of the curve there. Federally, though, we probably need to work out what happens since what happened on the weekend.
Yep.
let me leave it at that. And so, the work that Coal Australia and QRC are advocating for are all common sense things. And, for us, we're proud members of Coal Australia. We're proud members of the Queensland Resources Council and we're proud to mine coal in Queensland that supports communities.
Yeah, as you should be. What's next for you, Danny? You plan on sticking around at Terracom for a while or?
Yeah, of course. I've started something here and I intend to go, well into the future. Yeah, we've got some exciting stuff and, Moreland's for us has been a long gestation project. I know I started talking about it when I joined and it was on the table before I joined. So we're coming into 7 years now and, we've made a lot of progress, albeit from the outside it probably looks stagnant. It hasn't been. It's really something that's been well thought out and deliberate. And, we plan on building that project with the project owners and, that's our immediate focus is to make sure that is well understood and well planned. And once we get the ultimate approval green lights, then it's on with the execution. And, I think everyone will see the benefits of that flow through the region, the state and the community, which will provide, as I say, long-standing employment opportunities. I mean, people could literally start and end their careers with Terracom as a result of this project.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's so exciting, Danny. You've had such an interesting and adventurous career and I'm sure your family's proud. I'm sure your dad would have been too.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you so much. It's been nothing short of great. I don't take it for granted. And, as I've said, I've got plenty left to give and, I'm actively getting involved this year in pathways for young people into the industry, and we'll be beating down a few doors and opening a few otherwise locked opportunities for people and creating some ourselves and seeing if we can't challenge the norm and entice young people to come into mining and really demonstrate to them how good it can be and what a career it can be. And people like myself from the bush to the boardroom, I think, there's opportunities for people to get in and have a crack.
Yeah, definitely. So as you say, opportunities for your whole career. You can start, you can finish, you can go into so many different areas. The opportunities are endless, as cliche as it is. Danny, thank you so much for joining us on the Digging Deeper podcast. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much, Jess, for having me. I enjoyed it and, I really appreciate the work that you guys do as well. And as tireless supporters of coal. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for joining us for this episode of Digging Deeper with At The Coalface. You can download more episodes of the podcast on all your favourite podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, also on YouTube, Amazon Music, all the usual places. Make sure you leave us a rating and a review. We'd love to hear what you thought. And if you do have a story idea or something you'd like us to talk about on the podcast, please send me an email, jess@thecoalface.net.au. I'd love to hear from you. And we'll be back next time for another episode of Digging Deeper with At The Coalface.